Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last March, the Heartland Institute, a Chicago-based libertarian think tank, mailed 350,000 books and DVDs to thousands of public high school science teachers across the country. The material encouraged teachers to challenge the scientific consensus that carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels is heating the planet. A couple of months later, the Heartland Institute's chief executive, Joseph Bast, was a guest of Donald Trump in the White House Rose Garden as he announced that the United States was pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The Heartland Institute's misinformation campaign got a lot of media attention and swift reactions by teachers and Democratic lawmakers. But the attack on science public education is nothing new. For years, Republican-dominated legislators and well-funded right-wing groups have successfully cast doubt on the scientific consensus on climate change. In 2016, researchers from Pennsylvania State University and the National Center for Science Education found that nearly two-thirds of school children in the United States are taught lessons on climate change that do not rise to the level of sound science education. The researchers found that many teachers were confused about the causes of climate change. So how is climate science actually taught in schools, and what is being done to prepare and educate the generation that will most likely be impacted by climate change the most? Today we are joined by Anne Reed, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education, a nonprofit that promotes and defends accurate and effective science education. For 36 years, the NCSE has worked to ensure evidence-based science is taught in public schools and classrooms. And Anne joins us in studio. Hi, Anne. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Belinda Jacobs, a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High School in Round Rock, Texas. Belinda Jacobs is also president of the National Earth Science Teachers Association, a nonprofit educational organization that works to advance and improve earth science education at all educational levels. And Belinda Jacobs joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Belinda. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, Anne, I want to start off with you. Over the past couple of years, we've done a lot of shows about the Trump administration's war on science and efforts to undo environmental regulations, removing climate change from government websites, calling climate change a hoax. And we have also seen right-wing attacks on climate science. What would you say? I mean, when we heard about the Heartland Institute sending out these booklets, and then just this spring, a new book from Cornell University was sent out to teachers called The Teacher-Friendly Guide to Climate Change. What are teachers dealing with right now in this political environment?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that this didn't start last year. The Heartland Institute actually sent out the first edition of that booklet and DVD in 2015. And it didn't really get much attention. And we drew attention to it, and we advised teachers, of course, not to use it. And teachers don't. I mean, Belinda will be able to speak to how teachers react to materials like that. But the reaction to it last year was heightened because people are on alert, because the Trump administration has really gone all in on this false narrative that climate change isn't settled. But the Heartland Institute has been working really hard to cast doubt on the science for a long time, and that really, once they've cast doubt on it, they win. And we really see that echoing in the classroom.
What would you add, Belinda, as a science teacher? What are you facing in this environment?
Well, we actually, I got that mail out, as a matter of fact, and one of our teachers, actually, one of our students at my school specifically, actually reacted to it and created her own website and performed her own skeptic analysis of it herself, which I think is great because the students are actually a little more savvy than we give them credit for, and they are more willing, even if they come into the classroom with some preconceived ideas that they may have heard, when we give them the science and we give them the evidence, they are more likely to go, okay, this is what I see, because they are learning what science is and how we determine good science. And we talk a lot about how do we compare what is good science versus what is unsubstantiated science, and or science in quotes, if you will. And so I feel like I haven't seen as much of the as much of that discord within my classroom per se. I do see it amongst some of the adults for sure. I see more skepticism, more denialism among colleagues who don't teach it versus the students who are in my classroom. But I know that a lot of the other earth science teachers who are in my organization have reacted to this, and that one book that you also mentioned is one that is something that is a counter to this, that I personally know who is distributing that, and I have to distribute that in my school as well.
What are you hearing from your colleagues? What did your colleagues say when they first received the Heartland Institute book and DVD?
Well, most of the science teachers, most of them were like, just kind of was like, this is trash. That's really what they were. But I do have some that, while they didn't buy into exactly how Heartland was presenting it, they do, in their own mind, feel like there's more to the story, and they don't. And some of them, they don't totally deny that change is occurring. It's more the anthropomorphic change itself, and that we are causing so much of that piece of it. And that's where I see the skepticism happening amongst colleagues. But I also think that some of those same colleagues are open to looking further at the science. So we're still working on them. And the students are too. That's the thing.
We should also mention that in 2012, leaked documents show that some of the Heartland Institute's initiatives and climate change strategy included a tailored high school curriculum. And the documents also showed that they were receiving money from the Koch Foundation to, quote, cast doubt on the scientific findings that fossil fuel emissions endanger the long-term welfare of the planet. And what else did you hear from teachers across the country? I mean, did you have to put out a campaign to respond to the Heartland Institute to let teachers know where this was coming from and who's funding these books and DVDs?
It would be wonderful if we could just get a message out to every teacher in the country. That's actually quite a challenging thing to do. Education is completely decentralized in this country, and states have their own standards. Each individual district has to follow the state standards, but often has a lot of autonomy in how they implement them. And then behind the classroom door, the teacher has to manage whatever situation he or she finds herself or himself in, in a lot of parts of the country, their kids are coming in with a lot of misconceptions about climate change and evolution, which is another issue that we work on. And the teacher really has to manage that kind of incipient conflict. And good science teachers like Belinda know that if you present the students with the evidence and let them dig into it themselves, they will come to the same conclusion as the scientific community because the evidence is that strong. But the teachers who don't know how to teach that way or are really concerned about pushback from their communities, they may choose, in this case, since the forces that have been trying to cast doubt on climate change have been so successful, they may decide, you know, the easier way to do this is just to have a debate. Let's have kids debate whether the scientists know or don't know, or whether the climate is changing or not changing, which is not scientifically defensible. But I think it's important to take a step back and say that attitudes towards climate change have very little to do with level of scientific knowledge or level of education. It's really a matter of political identity, and is becoming more and more so that if you identify as a Republican, if you listen to Fox News and you get your Facebook feed from other people who think as you do, you're going to be constantly being told that this doubt is real, that this science is not settled, and that the other side is trying to change your way of life. And so just presenting the science, just saying, but the science is settled, doesn't have any impact because you're not a trusted communicator to those communities. So that's really where we feel that we need to focus our efforts is to get beyond that identity and say, here, really look at the evidence and make up your own mind.
The Yale Program on Climate Change Communication spent the better part of March of this year interviewing 1,300 adults across the country, asking them for their views on climate change. And they found that 78% believe that teachers should educate the next generation about climate change.
So that's great news. But that 78% is not spread equally across every school district. Mm. So for some teachers, that's not the environment they find themselves in.
Belinda, you are a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High School in Round Rock, Texas. What does the curriculum look like in Round Rock in your school district? And then is every school district different in Texas? How does that work?
Oh, yeah. We are all independent school districts. So each, while we have a state set of standards as was said before, we have a state set of standards. I can't talk. Called the TEKS, and we have embedded earth science in our elementary and middle school levels. Our middle school has integrated earth science. Most of it happens at the eighth grade level and sixth grade level, and then I teach high school, and so it is not required in high school. However, I teach, I have taught an earth and space science class in which that was there. And the curriculum in many, because it's an elective course, as far as in that course, the curriculum in a lot of districts is very minimal. I have been fortunate because I was part of a curriculum project for 5 years. An NSF-funded grant project with the University of Texas at Austin, UT El Paso, and Texas A&M University. And we developed a scope and sequence for this course, as well as other earth science courses that were aligned to our standards, but also were correlated with the NGSS and all of that as well, and utilized resources that were freely available on the web that we vetted and reviewed through CERC's the Science Education Resource Center at Carleton College's review system, and we compiled and put these together. So I piloted that curriculum in my course rather than using what my district had with permission. And then I also, the last 2 years, I piloted the geoscience course through OnRamps, which is a dual enrollment program with UT Austin, and they utilized a lot of our curriculum that Dig Texas Blueprints Project had done, as well as their own curriculum. So the courses I taught, the way I taught my course was different than a lot of people across my state, because they may not have had the same access to resources, or they weren't involved in those projects like I was involved in. And the fact that it's not offered everywhere. I was, at the time that I piloted the first Earth and Space Science course at my school, I was the only teacher in my entire district with five high schools teaching an Earth and Space Science course. And I had one class.
Wow.
So think about that. So the big thing is, so we have aquatic science. So you get a lot of that in that course as well, right? But you also get some of that in, a little bit of it in biology, which every freshman takes. You can kind of embed some of that in there. But if you are not strong, or you're not confident in what you're teaching or how to put that in there, then a lot of times the kids aren't even really getting it. Hmm. And I teach a multitude of classes, and I try, and if it's something that I can allude to or I can bring up, earth science in general, including climate change and everything else, global change in general, I do that as much as I can, because that's a big mission of NESTA, of our organization, is to really educate all of our kids, regardless of whether or not they're in a, you know, stated earth science course or not. So
Belinda is raising something, you know, that's true really nationwide, that earth science is generally not a required course in high school. But the good news from the point of view of teaching climate change is our survey in 2015 showed that lots of teachers outside the earth sciences are teaching about climate change. Biologists, a vast majority of biology teachers are teaching it, and even 30 to 35% of physics and chemistry teachers report that they're spending at least an hour or two on climate change. No one would call that ideal, but it does mean that most students somewhere between 7th and 12th grade do learn something about climate change. And when you consider that it hasn't been in the standards historically, because the consensus on climate change is only about 25 years old. So 25 years seems like that should be plenty of time to get it into the standards. But it takes a long time for new science to make it all the way into standards and textbooks. Belinda mentioned the NGSS, which stands for the Next Generation Science Standards. They were developed by a consortium of states and have now been adopted in about 22 states, I think. And they cover climate change really well, starting in elementary school with the effect of humans on the environment, and then working their way towards more in-depth scientific information about it. As those are implemented, I think we'll see more consistency in how it's taught.
And why does it take so long?
Well, it's a big deal, you know, to change your science standards, and we wouldn't want it to be done cavalierly.
Right.
Each state has its own schedule. They usually review their science standards every 5 to 7 years. And so the NGSS were completed Belinda, about 8 years ago?
I think so.
And so the states that happened to have their standards coming around to be renewed then did it then, and then each year another 4 or 5 states are looking at it. And so every year a couple more states adopt them. And even states that don't adopt them often adopt something that's similar to them. And even if the state doesn't adopt them, there are some school districts that decide to base their curriculum on them so long as it's consistent with the state standards. So it's just a huge challenge when you've got 15,000 school districts and they are acting independently. The good news is a teacher like Belinda can do something amazing. The bad news is the teachers who aren't out there really trying to keep up with the cutting edge are teaching the same thing they taught 30 years ago.
Ann Reed is Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education, a nonprofit that promotes and defends accurate and effective science education. Belinda Jacobs is a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High School in Round Rock, Texas, and president of the National Earth Science Teachers Association. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about what children learn about climate change in schools. What is being taught in the classroom? How are science teachers responding to groups like the Heartland Institute that are casting doubt on climate change and that have been sending around books and DVDs called Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming? If you are a teacher, we'd love to hear from you. What does it look like in your district? And what do you teach about climate change? And if you have a child in school, what is your child learning about these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Belinda, we've been doing so many shows about the teacher strikes across the country, about low teacher pay, just the lack of support you have in the classroom. And in your case, as a teacher in Texas, a science teacher, last year you had to deal with the Texas Education Board approving curriculum that challenges evolution. Can you give us an update on that, and how did teachers respond when that passed?
Nothing was changed in my district. Our biology teachers are still teaching about evolution the same way they've been teaching. My course, my curriculum has not changed, and we, as far as earth science, my earth and space science and the fossil record and teaching that how species have evolved over time, none of that has really changed. So while there might be some things in our legislature that sometimes come up, they don't always fully manifest. And the standards themselves weren't changed. What they have done with our standards is simplify some of them. We had a lot of very cumbersome standards, especially when you look at the earth science one specifically. It's almost impossible to teach everything in the way that it's written over the course of the school year. But at the same time, it takes time for things to trickle down. We were talking about the type of time it takes to change curriculum or to change standards. And you're talking about committees and subcommittees and teacher committees and districts. I mean, it takes a long time. And they were just revising some of our science standards or like I said, simplifying in this last round, which didn't even go into effect this past year as initially thought. In the end, it hasn't really changed much. I haven't seen any flack from that. It will be interesting to see what happens in the next few years. If something does come in where it persists that there are some major changes. Hmm. But I honestly haven't seen anything in my district as far as that's concerned.
And Anne, PBS reported that in 2017, Idaho lawmakers removed references to climate change from the state's science standards. In Alabama and Indiana, they passed resolutions urging support for educators who teach, quote, diverse views on climate change, evolution, and human cloning. And then in Florida, the legislature adopted a bill that would give residents new power to oppose classroom materials they don't like, including science textbooks. Well, there's a lot of things happening in different states. What really stands out for you, Anne?
Well, this isn't new, and this is what NCSE was founded to deal with, were these kinds of attacks on the integrity of the science classroom. And they have, you'll excuse the irony, evolved over the years that in the early years, it was just flat out creation science should be taught alongside evolution. That is unconstitutional. And so now it has gotten to this point where it's often a bill saying teachers should have academic freedom to teach both sides, to teach critical thinking, to teach the strengths and weaknesses of various theories. So we always are available to help local community members push back against changes like that, and we're almost always successful. And there's always a lot of grassroots support for ensuring that what kids learn in science class is good science, even in places that we think of as very conservative. And there are a lot of Republicans who want their kids to get a good science education. So it's really not when you really get down to the brass tacks of what's being taught in the schools, there's a lot of support on all sides for it being accurate.
And how do you respond when this legislation is passed? What does your organization do to stand up for science teachers?
Well, we are really more in the role of a facilitator, that we help those people who live in that community to push back in an effective way. Science teachers are great allies. Local scientists, like we had a situation in New Mexico last year also with respect to the science standards. The Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists wrote letters. So we help those people know what to do. When is the public comment period open? When are the hearings when you might be able to go and make a 3-minute statement? What should you be sure you cover in your 3 minutes? That kind of really practical sort of grassroots activism skills that people, especially scientists, really might not have. We just help them, and then they make the case for themselves.
That is Anne Reed, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. It's a nonprofit that promotes and defends accurate and effective science education. Today, we're also joined by Belinda Jacobs, a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High School in Round Rock, Texas. Belinda is also president of the National Earth Science Teachers Association. And on today's Your Call, it's our One Planet series. We are talking about what is being taught in classrooms about climate change and how are science teachers responding to efforts to water down what is being taught in science classes. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Randi Hutter Epstein about her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Mood swings and puberty are often associated with hormones, but they also affect metabolism, sleep, behavior, and the immune system. So we'll talk about how hormone imbalances affect just about all of us. Today, we are talking about what children learn about climate change in schools across the country. We're joined by Ann Reed, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education, and Belinda Jacobs, a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High School in Round Rock, Texas, and president of the National Earth Science Teachers Association. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, or if you are a teacher, how do you teach climate change in classes? If you have a child in school, what is your teacher learning? You can email yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Let's hear from Harry in San Jose. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rosegula. Thanks for the taking up the call. My question is related to, in American classrooms and other things, I have noticed if we are really serious about climate change, we also have to think about the way we are living the American life. In the sense, the way we are disposing of so much materials and things like that, which you have discussed in your previous series. So that thing has to be cultivated in the school children too. So it's not only the laws probably, but the way the people lead their life. That will have a major impact on the climate change, too.
Yes, it's such a good point. Belinda, how are these issues taught in school? Plastic pollution, for example, the importance of recycling, how are things recycled, the agriculture, big ag and its effect on climate change, what's going on with the oceans. I mean, there's just so many issues right now. How's that being taught in your school in Texas?
Well, on the academic side, our earth science course is a very comprehensive systems-based course, and it includes the interaction of all of the systems, including climate and how what's in the ocean affects climate, and then humans' impact on the environment. And we go into pollution of the oceans. We talk about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. We develop PSAs about that. The kids really learn a lot about pollution and our impact from an early age. I'm fortunate to live in a suburb and teach in a suburb of Austin, which is very environmentally sensitive. In a lot of ways, we have our Edwards Aquifer, which is an environmentally sensitive watershed area. And we have single stream recycling almost everywhere. That's really promoted in our schools. Most schools, like every classroom, has a recycling bin, and there's an organization on campus that comes in and collects it. I focus a lot on in our cafeterias, about that recycling piece too, and share that with our students. I'm always saying to all my students and my student groups, even if for the clubs I lead and all of that as well. Our students are very a lot more savvy when it comes to that and are aware. I try to also, I think and our teachers in general just really promote that a lot. I see that a lot around us. That's a lot related to where I live specifically too. And the fact that we have those available to us. We're very fortunate for that. Not every community has Not every community makes it easy for people to do things like recycling, which is just one piece of the puzzle, but it's an important piece of the puzzle, and it's one way that we can all make an impact.
Right, Anne.
So this is Belinda raises this point again that it's so local. Mm-hmm. The environment you're teaching in makes such a big difference. But our national survey did suggest that most teachers don't only teach about what's happening with climate change and this sort of scientific basis for knowing that CO2 is warming the climate and the the nitty-gritty of the science, which is important, they're also linking that big picture knowledge to what's going on in their own communities. What's the evidence of climate change in your community? And they're also linking it to what can be done about it. That is a little bit of a sensitive step, because obviously the response to climate change is not only a scientific response. It depends on your values and your politics and what do you think is, you know, what's the risk level and what's the cost. So teachers can certainly show students, give students lots of ways to investigate how they themselves can make a difference, how their community can make a difference. And our survey showed that teachers are doing that. And it's important because otherwise it can be an enormously depressing topic. So it's important to give students some sense of there's hope, there are things we can do, even you can do something. That's an important part of the education.
Right. You remind me of a documentary we did a show about called Straw. And it focuses on the history of straws and how straws are affecting the ocean. There was a horrible video of a straw that got caught up a turtle's nose. Mm. And it's probably okay for high school students, but definitely not younger students. Mm-hmm. But what a great document. I mean, there's so many amazing documentaries out right now that are great for kids to learn about these issues.
And there is local evidence in every single community in America. Every community has some, whether they have agriculture, or whether they have refineries, whether they have manufacturing, whether they have a big research university. There are places that students can go and get a sense of what's going on around me. And we know that that's much more motivating for students than keeping it all on an abstract global level.
Right. And I mean, it's just very depressing for adults. Although what's amazing about kids is they get it. I mean, once you give them the information, they say, well, what can we do about this? I'm just spending the weekend with my 7-year-old niece, and she was asking all these questions about, well, what is it recycling and where does it go after that? And is this good for the planet? There's so much new information coming at us on a regular basis. And how do teachers keep up with all of the information and the latest scientific findings?
Well, I think that we should all be writing thank you notes to teachers every single day. And it's an enormous job. And in the sciences, you know, that the information is growing and deepening and getting richer every single day. And to keep up with that when you're also teaching maybe a couple hundred students a year, is really hard. And we did find, I keep mentioning our survey, and I should just tell people that we did a nationwide survey of climate change teaching practices 3 years ago now, and all of the results are available on our website, which is ncse.com. If you type mixed messages into the search box, you'll find the report that details all of the responses that the teachers gave. But one of the things that was really disheartening is that very few teachers report having learned about climate change in school themselves. And if they got out of school more than 10 years ago, they wouldn't have learned much about it. So that it's on them to go back and learn about it, because professional development has been scratched back to the bone in so many places. Mm-hmm. But the teachers overwhelmingly said, we'd love to learn more about climate change. We don't feel confident about the content. Please, please, please give us more professional development. So, again, you don't want to step too far over into political activism, but parents need to be putting pressure on their school boards and their boards of education to provide more professional development for teachers.
Belinda, have you received professional development at your school on this issue?
Not so much at my school, but here's the thing. I got my master's degree in geosciences, and that was in 2011. And so I received a lot of instruction through my climatology classes, oceanography, geology, all of that, right? Because I took all those courses. But being involved in hearing about different grant projects, there's so many out there that are working on ways to reach teachers. So, for instance, the Earth Labs project has several modules on CERC. I was part of, I reviewed and tested several of their lessons because I was part of the people who were in charge of climate and the there are some modules on different ones on climate. One is called Climate in the Biosphere, one's called Climate in the Cryosphere, one's called Climate in the Carbon Cycle. And they're all different. There's also another one on, can't remember the other one. There's another one on climate that my good friend was a developer on as well. And I went to workshops that presented those modules, and then I piloted those in my classroom. So I think teachers have to be, especially science teachers, and I think there's an innate piece of us that is curious and is always learning, and I'm not saying that not all teachers are doing this, they are, but science teachers specifically really are about problem solving, and they find that, okay, well, my school's not offering this, or my district's not offering this, because they're looking at the big picture of what can impact all teachers as opposed to just this one sect of teachers. And so it is kind of on us to continue our education and to really promote looking for where's a more recent, where can I get better information, where can I get more up-to-date information. So as a part of the Texas Revolution, which is the Texas Earth and Space Science Revolution, that was also a big five-year project, and I was in cohorts of teachers for that, that introduced me to the Earth Labs project at CERC, that introduced me to the master's program I became a part of, that introduced me to people who piloted who were the PIs on the Dig Texas Blueprints project. And so as a result of all that, I became familiar with CLEAN, which is another wonderful resource that Cheryl Manning, our past president, was a developer on. Lots of vetted, good resources for looking at climate science and other earth science topics. There are so many resources out there. It's about knowing which ones are credible. And so the project I was on, that was a big part of what we were doing, was we were looking and finding those credible resources and then compiling them together and then giving teachers something that they can read about, say, okay, this is how I use this. I know this has been vetted. These are by people who know what they're talking about. It's not just some random Joe off the street that put this up on the web, because on the web there's so much there, and how do you know? It's because of these types of projects, and I have been very fortunate. The last decade really is when all this kind of started for me, as far as being introduced to a lot of it when I taught eighth grade earth science at the time, before I taught high school, and my journey in all of this. And I've really kind of compiled a network of people, going to Geological Society of America, so building that network with other scientists, and not just other K-12 educators, but university professors and researchers, and going to those conferences and going to AGU, which is another one, American Geophysical Union, and going to NSTA, National Science Teachers Association conferences. And you're really getting that sense of, okay, here's good science, here are people I can contact when I have questions. And the big part that my school has taken in that is I've had really good administrators. Happened to have an administrator who was a science teacher in her form before she was an administrator. And she, while they may not have provided all the PD for me, she always supported me in allowing me to go. And so, and excuse me from school and let me have a sub and all of that, so that I could go and be a part of that when I presented at conferences or when I was learning at conferences, as a part of these projects. So I think that's the big thing, is teachers have to be willing to kind of get out there, be the student, like they tell their students to do. They tell us, we always tell our students, you know, be a lifelong learner, get out there. If you don't know something, go look for it. And that's what we kind of have to do. And I think most teachers will do that, but there are some out there that aren't willing to do the work. I mean, I let's be honest, you know, you're going to have that in every field. But I think most science teachers in general tend to be naturally curious and we'll push for that better product.
Well, the evidence definitely shows that science teachers are much more likely to accept the evidence-based science than the general population. Mm-hmm. So that's a great thing, that science teachers generally are not teaching the opposite of the settled science, although some are. But there is this very large group of teachers. In the case of evolution, it's actually 60% of high school biology teachers. And in the case of climate science, our survey found about 40% of teachers are in this sort of middle ground of, they're not really teaching it the way the science would suggest. They're not teaching the opposite, but they're not really doing, that's why we named our report Mixed Messages, that a lot of teachers are sending these mixed messages. And there are these 30 to 40% of teachers like Belinda who are out there every single day knocking it out of the park and learning more and more and forming these connections, really digging through the massive information that's on the web to get the best things for their students. But there is this 40 to 50% of teachers who aren't doing that. Either they're overwhelmed, they don't have the scientific background to sort through that information. For whatever reason, they're sort of settled at a place where they're not teaching the best science that they could be. We think that a lot of that is because they are reluctant to take on topics that are likely to bring on conflict. Mm-hmm. Many of them don't have really a good scientific background in these, especially contentious areas. So what we're trying to do is figure out how do we make more teachers, like, how do we make it easy for lots of teachers to be more like Belinda?
Do you have any idea how teachers have been influenced by these million-dollar doubt campaigns by companies like Exxon and Chevron and the Koch brothers?
The news is not good. Again, most science teachers accept that climate change is happening and humans are responsible. But one of the questions on our survey was what percentage of climate scientists agree that climate is changing and humans are responsible. The correct answer to that is virtually 100%. The top range that we gave was 80 to 100%, so pretty forgiving. Do you think that 4 out of 5 scientists agree with this? Only 40% of science teachers agreed with that statement.
Wow.
And that was what I found really interesting, is even the teachers who report that they themselves accept the science, they teach the science, they're totally on board with the science, even they, 40% of them, did not know that it's settled science. So if you have this situation where so many teachers have been infected by this doubt, it's not so surprising that many of them are teaching it as a debate. If you think 1 in 5 scientists disagrees, then it's a sort of appropriate to leave it up in the air, but it's not appropriate scientifically. So this doubt campaign has been really tragically effective.
What role do you think the media have played in all of this? Because it seems like up until maybe a couple of years ago, climate change was really still framed as a debate in the national news.
Well, I think that you come up in a sort of a cultural clash between journalism and science. That I think you could tell me. I think journalists are generally encouraged to show both sides, and science doesn't work that way. I mean, we have ferocious debates in science about the evidence, but once the evidence is clear, we stop debating that and move on to what's the next issue that where we don't know the answer and where we really have to then explore the evidence. And I think that that's hard for journalists to frame a story if they have to say, well, there's no debate here anymore. This is just a done deal. But I think that it's getting better on climate change, that desire to present two sides is just becoming less and less tenable.
Today we're joined by Ann Reed, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. For 36 years, the center has worked to ensure evidence-based science is taught in public schools across the country. Belinda Jacobs is a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High in Round Rock, Texas, and president of the National Earth Science Teachers Association. And today we're talking about how children are taught climate change at a time when millions of dollars are being spent to sow doubt around climate change. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments, if you're a teacher, if you have children in school, what are they learning in school? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And do we see this in other countries, in European countries? Teachers who are under pressured to have debates, or different laws that are passed to remove climate change from books, or
no?
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Most countries have a much more centralized education system, and standards are made at the national level and pretty strictly implemented. And there are certainly days when I really long for that for our country. But I lived in France for a long time, and I know that many of the children that were babies when I left and have now grown up, I talked to them about their science classes, and they said they're often quite out of date because it is this national process. And so the old standards, the standard textbooks, and even the tests don't change over time. And so they reported having their teachers say, you know, this is not really what scientists think anymore, but this is what's going to be on the test. So say this, but this is... So that's not good either. And we have a situation, much as with our healthcare, where you have some school districts and some teachers who are absolutely fantastic and well-funded and well-trained, and other districts where education is not a priority. Science teachers are not as required to have the same credentials. And so we have this bell curve of fantastic and not so great and a bunch of stuff in the middle that's just endemic to our system. But to answer your immediate question, we don't have any countries that are systematically taking climate change or evolution, for that matter, out of their standards.
Mm. Belinda, is there a school district here in the U.S. or maybe a model overseas that you kind of look up to, or where we can learn from?
I honestly, there's not any in particular. All of my experience, again, has been in Texas, and we kind of do things our own way. Mm. But which is good in a lot of ways, but in other ways, it's not. But I will say that I do like some of the things that New York has put into place when it comes to earth science education, for sure. The rigor of the standards and the Regents exam and all of that process. When you look at that, when you look at what the level of science is, it's pretty good. And so there are a lot of good things, but here's the thing. I don't think there's any one that is just astounding. And then ones that have been really great in the past have reverted and pulled it out of their schools. Take the case of California, for instance, not being a requirement anymore. And there are a lot of teachers there that are not happy about that. There are a lot of earth science teachers who it's been a struggle. And they're wondering how to integrate this into those core classes. So I don't really see that as much. I think the things, though, that we can do as far as this is concerned and any controversial subjects is to continue to teach our kids how to look at it, right? And one of the things that we do when we teach climate science is we use this idea of disinformation, and we use the Union of Concerned Scientists put out on the disinformation playbook, where they really take a topic and we teach the kids, this is what happens out there when what some businesses or corporations put out there as science that isn't science. And it kind of exposes the students to, this is what you might see. And I think teaching our students to really analyze and evaluate what they're reading, what is being presented to them as science, and really look at who's putting it out, what might be their motivation, how are they wording it, are they wording it in a way to manipulate thought? I mean, all of that is something that, while we may not have the most perfect curriculum, and that's always being revised, everything we change, I change every year how I'm doing things, right? They can at least get some skills to analyze the things that are given to them and really see what is true science. And I think that is applicable across the spectrum, whether we're talking about evolution or climate change or any other hot topic, science topic that maybe they're not getting the full piece of it in their school, but then they can actually learn this for themselves. Because at the end of the day, we want them to know it, regardless of whether or not it was their teacher that did the best job of doing it.
And NPR ran a story a couple of years ago about Oklahoma being Oklahoma teachers who are trained to instruct K-12 education. It's a curriculum funded by the oil and gas industry. The lesson plans were created by the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board. They've been used in Kansas. The model has been pitched to five other states, and they're choosing states that have massive budget issues because of tax cuts. And so they're teaching very strange things to kids, like calculating the mileage of tanker trucks, the slope of pipelines, and it's all coming from the oil and gas industry. How common is this, and what are you doing about this issue?
I actually hadn't heard about that, so that's very, very interesting. But I'm not surprised, because, again, education is completely decentralized. And if outside interests come along and provide what looks like a terrific curriculum that teaches the kids lots of math and is locally relevant and has lots of qualities that make it look like it would be a good resource, and they're providing it for free, that's going to be tempting. So it's an issue of educating everybody, not just the science teachers and not just students, but that science is not a static set of facts between the pages of a textbook. It's a process. So when Belinda was talking about having students learn, how do you evaluate evidence? How do you decide whether the evidence is credible? How do you look at the source of the evidence and what does that tell you about it? That's almost more important for students to learn in science than any particular set of facts. But we tend to think about science as a set of facts, and it's tested as a set of facts. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the next generation science standards really try to turn that upside down and have it be taught as it is practiced.
And obviously, it'd be good for all of kids to learn about pipelines and tanker trucks and all of that, but who's determining how that's being taught?
Exactly.
We don't have time to take Ruby's call, but she wanted to know, what else would adults be surprised by in the classroom in terms of what's currently being taught? Did anything else stand out for you in the study?
Well, I guess from my point of view as a Californian, and knowing that climate change is generally taught well here and the teachers generally agree with it, is the degree to which all teachers are affected by all of their other identities. So that teachers who teach climate change appropriately are often not really any better on the content than teachers who teach it inappropriately. So they're teaching the right thing, but they're not necessarily teaching it because they really know more about the science. They're teaching it because their community agrees with it. And I think what we're trying to solve at NCSE is making sure that teachers also have the scientific content knowledge and the knowledge of how to teach a topic that is likely to be contentious, because you need that too, the content and the skills, conflict management skills, to really make sure that kids not only hear the facts, but really absorb the facts.
And final thoughts from you, Belinda. Any tips to teachers who are thinking about these issues and want to bring more information about climate change into their classrooms?
I would say just to arm yourself with the science. I mean, and really bring that. And again, transferring those skills over to the students of let's evaluate these resources together. Let's look at what they're saying here. Is this sound? In the order of the curriculum that I teach it in, by the time we get to really talking about climate as a whole, they've learned about solid Earth, fluid Earth, the atmosphere. They've already learned all of these facts, and so they have this foundation. So when we get to climate and we tie it all together and we see how these things have impacted, and I've given them little nuggets all year long, they really accept that. And so I think not being afraid. Also, I think there are a lot of teachers who are just afraid of rocking the boat. And yes, there's a time and place for everything, but I think that this is science. And that's what I always tell my kids. This is science. This is what the science says. And just not being afraid to rock the boat and just be very matter-of-fact about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. Belinda Jacobs is a science teacher at Cedar Ridge High in Round Rock, Texas. Ann Reed is executive director of the National Center for Science Education. Belinda and Ann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.